Hello, hello. Hi, everybody. I will have you all take a seat and we'll get started. Welcome. I'm Becca. I will introduce myself as we're going. We're talking about the worrisome world, which I feel like is just the world that we live in. I'm going to start by sitting because otherwise I talk about 100, 200 words a minute. So I'll sit here for a minute while we get started. But I'm going to start by kind of introducing who I am. So I think it's always a little bit easier to listen to somebody when you know a little bit more about who they are. So if we could go to the next slide, this would be my crew. These are my people. I think that that's kind of always a good place to start. So if you look at the top there, the girl in the top left corner, that's my daughter. She's my oldest. I've got four kids. So her name is Hope. She is in third grade. She's 9. The next little guy there is Zeke. He is 7. The next little guy there is 5. He's Luke. The littlest goon there on the second row is Titus, and he is 3. And those are my four kids. The next person there is my mom. My parents live across the street from us. I tell my patients on a somewhat regular basis that I cheat at life because who is blessed enough to have their parents across the street? It's just amazing. And then the next person there is my hubby. We've been married for about 15 years. He's a former pastor, now realtor. We have just an awesome life. I'm just so, so thankful. What this collection of pictures is a long-standing family tradition for us. With my husband being a pastor, we all got real used to being at church on Christmas Eve, and so we decided that instead of that being a weird thing, we were going to have that be a fun thing. And so we, being there just real late when everybody else is celebrating Christmas. And so we pack a present, a box, and wrap it up. And it always has matching jammies in it. And we come home from church in our matching jammies. So we all change at church, take a picture every single year in our matching jammies at church, like everybody, and then come home, have a movie night, and then we actually wear those jammies out the rest of the year to go get donuts at the end of fun events. So like at the end of Christmas break, spring break, our kids know in no uncertain terms that if they stop having fun with us in this way, that we will be very happy to wear our matching jammies to meet them at high school on a regular basis. So anyway, this is our crew. We have just so much fun. My parents get the same matching jammies with us all the time. My dad was working on this particular day, you know, like a responsible adult. But anyway, so this is my crew. If we could go to the next slide, those are my people. In my professional life, I am a nurse practitioner. I work at the Alina Clinic Buffalo, and I absolutely love my job. I just think that I am so blessed to get to love what I do. The Alina Clinic in Buffalo is an Alina Clinic. It is a traditional clinic. We do a lot of traditional things. I'm trained in some non-traditional things as well. The second picture there that I'm sure all of you are looking at going, well, that doesn't really look like you, is an infographic that I found of a witch doctor. Of all of the things that I thought that nobody would ever call me, it would be witch doctor, but I definitely have a patient that tells everybody that I am his witch doctor, and I just get a kick out of it every single time. So this young man was in his early 20s when he first started to see me, and at that time, he had really, really a lot of issues. He was passing out almost daily. He's had about 22 concussions because he's hit his head so many times from passing out. He was having issues where he was having a lot of bleeding that would show up in the toilet. And then he also was having a lot of mental health issues. He was a schizophrenic. It took him a long time to tell me, but that every single time he ever saw me, there were 3 other people in the room with us that only he could see. We slowly kind of started to work through those issues, and we got him kind of changing some of the foods that he was eating, getting him on a probiotic, and his bowel issues started to clear up, and we got him eating more, eating a little bit better diet, and actually increasing his salt, and he started to no longer pass out. And then we changed his diet really dramatically and started him on some supplements, and he no longer has any hallucinations. And so he calls me his witch doctor and tells me that he will not, that he is a very kind of just free sort of a person. He would move anywhere and do anything kind of a guy. And he goes, I just know I can't leave Minnesota because I'm not going to find another witch doctor anywhere. So like I said, of all the things that, I mean, I don't think anybody looks at me and go, you're a witch doctor. But apparently this is what he tells the world. And I just think it's so, so funny. So that is who I am. we're going to kind of move into more of what our topic is now. And so that's our next slide. And so we all know that COVID and the world right now has kind of gotten flipped upside down. And so I think that even people that have not had any issues with worry or anxiety in the past are now thinking about their lives in a different way. And I just think that, oh, the world has made everybody feel a little bit crazy at times lately. And so COVID itself, I mean, just and all of the policies surrounding that have made people, so many people feel kind of nutty. But in addition, we also know that the statistics on COVID say that for every 3 people that get a COVID diagnosis, 1 in 3 of those people is going to have a new onset of a mental health disorder, whether that be depression, anxiety, dementia, or a change or worsening of those things. So in addition to everything that the world is doing to us, there's this new disease that we don't really understand that's also causing us to have just so many more troubles. The political nature of the world, I think, has also just made everybody feel like there's so many extremes, and it's you have to kind of pick a side, and that messes with people's anxiety. Things like working from home and then all of a sudden transitioning back to work and all of that, just that back and forth, all of that takes such a toll on our brain and how we think about depression and anxiety and all of those things. The research on that has been done previously on kind of depression and anxiety says that if anybody has 2 significant changes in their life in the span of a year, and those can be good changes or bad things. So that can be things like bringing home a new baby and buying your dream house, but it could also be things like losing a job and having someone die. All of those things would count as 2 major changes. And so things like going from working at a job that you're going to staying at home, that would be a major change. Any school changes for your kids, that would be a major change. And so essentially, COVID has put everybody's brain in a state where we are all at risk to be experiencing new depression or anxiety in a way that we would have never thought about that before. Daniel Goldblum has a book called Emotional Intelligence. And in that book, he references a 1993 study. And it says that anxiety it was a comprehensive study, but it says that anxiety has such a broad spectrum of effects on our brain that it compromises our immune system to the point that it can speed up cancer. It increases vulnerability of viral diseases. It increases plaque formation in the heart, so heart disease, and accelerates the onset of type 1 and the course of type 2 diabetes and worsens and triggers asthma attacks. So like, while we all think about anxiety largely as a mental health thing, it so drastically affects our physical health in just staggering ways. A 2021 review of what anxiety looks like in our country right now says that 19.1% of all people currently in the U.S. have a diagnosis that encompasses anxiety in some way. 31.1% of us will have an anxiety-type diagnosis in our lifetime. And so the statistics on all of this are just going through the roof. Next slide, if we could. The Bible does speak to anxiety, though. And I just think that, of course, God would speak to something that's so, so very important to all of this. And so Philippians 4:4-8, and I'll read that here in just a second. But Max Lucado has a book called Anxious for Nothing. And this is what he bases that book on. And so I'll just read this here with you, and then I'll kind of talk through kind of how he talks about it. And so Philippians 4:4-8, rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, with prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Max Lucado, in the book that I was saying, Anxious for Nothing, breaks this down into the acronym CALM. And so he starts with C, and he would say, celebrate God's goodness. And so rejoice in the Lord always is where he pulls that out of this section. And he says, if we are rejoicing in the Lord always, that is just such a good grounding thing for us. In Lisa Turker's book, Uninvited. When she wrote that book, she was, if you read it, she talks about it extensively, but she talks about how she was going through a time period where she had a really severe bowel issue that was going on. She was in the process of thinking that she was going to end up with a divorce. She was diagnosed with breast cancer. And in that book, she says that the thing that God kept bringing her back to is that God is good. God is good at being God. God is good at being God, and God is good to me. And so even in the midst of those really horrible life situations, I just think that if we can be grounded in knowing who God is, that is just so incredible for our brains and anxiety in general. The second thing, the A in calm, is ask God for help. And so let your requests be known to God. And so this is prayer. And I'm going to talk about prayer a couple of times while we're here today. But I think that prayer is also just a way of releasing control and letting God be God. The third thing there would be the L in calm, leave your concerns with him. And so, and he says that is with thanksgiving, that if we are asking, that then we also have to leave it there. And that does require a state of gratitude, essentially, because it is also saying, I trust you, God, enough to know that I can be thankful for whatever your answer will be, regardless of if it's the answer that I want or not. The M here is, and we're going to talk about gratitude a couple times too, the M here is meditate on the good things. And so this verse here, verse 8, I always chuckle a little bit when I come to Philippians 4:8, and I realize it's not a funny verse. But the reason that I chuckle is I grew up in a Christian home. And so if there was ever a time that we were watching TV or saying things to each other that were not nice when we were kids, or, you know, listening to music, something that was not maybe the best choice for us to be making, my mom would say this verse to us in a fairly angry voice. And so for years, I could only recite this verse if I said it in a slightly angry tone. But I do think that it's so important that we know that the things that we think about are, and this is going to sound silly, but the things that we think about are the things that we think about. And what I mean by that is that we know that there's a lot of study in the world of neuroplasticity right now, which is all about how we change our brain. And the things that we think about actually produce new pathways in our brain. And those new pathways can become our well-trudged paths, essentially. And so the things that we choose to think about are the things that our brain is going to go back to when we go into default mode. And so if our default mode is things that are pure and lovely and excellent and praiseworthy and admirable, those are the places that our brain is going to go to when it is in stress and just kind of going numb. But if we are allowing our brain to unconsciously go to places that are anxious or worried or troubled, those are the well-beaten paths in our brain. And I'm not saying, I wholeheartedly know that some of us are much more prone from a genetic standpoint or a personal standpoint or a place of trauma for those well-beaten paths to be those things. But I think that if we can make those efforts for them to be these other things, that we'll see a change. If we could go to the next slide, that would be great. The Bible also, in regards to anxiety, speaks to anxiety, and it also speaks to healing. I would have told you prior to my fourth kiddo, I never had an anxious day in my life. I don't think I would have known what anxiety was at all. And I will talk more about my fourth kiddo here in a minute. But I started to have some postpartum anxiety probably almost a full year after he was born. And it hit me like a Mack truck at times, where I would be driving home from work having had a completely fine day. And as I am driving, all of a sudden, I would be having images of I'm dying and my husband died, and my kids are orphans, and I don't know how they're getting food. And this is like where my brain would travel. My parents live across the street, if you remember that before, and our best friends live around the corner. If I died, my kids would still be some of the most loved kids that the world has ever met. And I know that from a logical place. So for my brain to go to these anxious places is just crazy to me. But anyway, still to this day, on the first day of my monthly friend, I usually have an anxious day. And I wouldn't say that my mind goes to some of those same places that I'm talking about before, but I just kind of get this nervous energy. And anyway, while I was preparing this, I had one of those days. I actually think that it was God did that for a reason, because I think he wanted to kind of remind me of some things. And the verse that kept coming to mind as I was having this day was Psalms 46:10, be still and know that I am God. And this is a verse that I have had, I think I had this actually on the mirror in my college dorm. So this is a verse that I'm really well acquainted with. But I will say, prior to all of this, I had always kind of considered it more of a contemplative sort of an exercise. Be still and know that God is, and know that I am God. But I decided to actually dig into this verse a little bit more and found out that The be still here is actually not a contemplative be still. I actually looked into some of the translation a little bit more, and it actually is to mean to stop fighting, lay down your arms, surrender. And I just think that that is so much more of a real place, I guess, to be in those moments when we don't know what to do. Psalms 46 is actually all about the world literally falling apart. It says that though the earth gives way and the mountains fall into the sea, that is actually how Psalms 46 starts. And so I also think that it's just really refreshing for us to think about the fact that, I mean, this is an Old Testament scripture, and this is not the first time that everybody has felt like the world is actually falling apart. But so even though this starts with a place of saying the world is falling apart and we're being told to stop, to like stop and be still, it is because it says God is our refuge and our strength, and behold the works of the Lord. And I think that if we can remember some of those times that we've seen God work before, that that is a way that we can stop and surrender. And so I think that sometimes we need to go through in our own heads and say, God, where have I seen you work before? And if we can't do that for ourselves, turn to somebody else and say, where have you seen this before? And how do I get through this? In Psalm 46, it also uses the word Selah 3 times. And Selah is a Hebrew term that's really debated about what it actually means. But most people believe that it is a musical term and that it means pause and think about that. And so I would just encourage you to pause and think about the fact that we don't need to fight, that God is already victorious in all of this, regardless of what that means for where we are at in our own physical or mental journey. The next verse that I have listed up there is Psalms 30, verses 2 through 3. All of this, you can actually, I will read it. And so, O Lord, my God, I cried to you for help, and you have healed me. O Lord, you have brought my soul up from Sheol. You have restored my life from among those who go down into the pit. And so Psalms 30 actually is more of a psalm that is about actually more depression than anxiety. But I will tell you statistically, they are very, very linked. I started to pray Psalm 30, verse 2, actually, for my fourth kid. And he was, so he is doing great now. You all saw him on the screen. He is now 3. We went to my 20-week ultrasound with him, and I ended up starting to pray this verse for him shortly after that. And at my 20-week ultrasound, we sat down thinking that it was a normal ultrasound, no big deal whatsoever. And at that ultrasound, the person that was doing my ultrasound, that ultrasound tech, had 25 years of experience. And I'm a nurse practitioner. I don't look at fetal ultrasounds on a regular basis, but enough to kind of know if something looks normal or not. And she put the wand down on my belly, and my little guy's kidneys took up almost the entire screen. His kidneys were about 2 to 3 times the size that they're supposed to be on that ultrasound. And I knew immediately that this looked really, really not good. His bladder took up another, like, almost all of his abdomen. It was a little scary looking. We'll just go with the solid scary looking. And if a baby's kidneys start to shut down, it starts to affect the development of their lungs really significantly, and this can actually wholeheartedly mean death very quickly. And our ultrasound looked bad enough that we were actually in to see the super specialists in this field, perinatology, 2 to 3 hours later. And this was a Friday night, and they actually stayed open late for us because they were thinking that we were going to have to do in utero surgery that weekend. That's how serious all of this looked. And in those two to three hours, I was as hot of a mess as you all would think that I would be. I was just crying. But in that moment, as I was crying, I can tell you, I didn't audibly hear God, but I really felt like God said to me, this is fine. I'm going to show you things that you have never seen before. And let me tell you, God showed me things that I have never seen before. And sorry, I tried to practice at home a couple times, and I have not gotten through this yet once without crying, guys. And so we went to that specialist 3 hours later, and by the time that we got there, my little guy's kidneys were normal, and they have been perfect since. Having said that, we got to that ultrasound, and we were told that he had, thanks, Jerry, and we were told that he had ambiguous genitalia. And we knew that he was genetically a little boy, And they said, and I quote, "It'll be a miracle if he ever has any chance at fertility." And we were told that he had a connection between his bowel and a bladder, at a subsequent appointment, we were told that that connection between his bowel and his bladder actually wasn't in a place that they ever see it from a congenital standpoint, that they actually think that his bladder sprung a leak into his colon so that his kidneys could drain, which, let me just tell you, God does those things. So we had that second ultrasound. His kidneys were perfect. We went to the next ultrasound 3 weeks later. And in that amount of time, we were praying, and we told basically everybody else, pray for our little guy. And we went to that next ultrasound. And, oh, he also had a growth from his abdomen that nobody could explain. And it looked like it came from right around where his umbilical cord was. And this was a very large perinatology clinic that we were at. We were told that his ultrasounds got passed around the entire clinic to every single perinatologist there because nobody could figure out what this was. And so we prayed. We were telling everybody, pray that the growth goes away and pray that God puts a penis on his little body, which, how awkward of a prayer to tell people to pray, guys. And my husband's one rule about medical stories in our house is don't tell me any penis stories. And so, of all of the things for this to be. But we started telling everybody, pray for a penis and pray for this growth to go away. And at this next appointment, 3 weeks later, we get there and that growth had shifted down and was now a penis. And still to this day, we tell this story to his now urologist. His urologist goes, Becca, every time you tell me this, I don't doubt you. And literally to this day, if my little guy has had any issues, the urologist will say to whatever doc we're actually seeing in his stead, just do whatever mom says. She knows her stuff. He absolutely trusts me. He says, Becca, every time you tell me this, I go, a huge penis is the opposite of no penis. And this mass was so big that it flipped up and it touched his chest. I will tell you, that's not where we're at these days. When I tell you that this is not, this was not a penis. This was an abdominal growth. I mean that wholeheartedly. So we had issue after issue after issue like this. We were told that he had this syndrome and the next syndrome and the next syndrome. And every time we went in, the next ultrasound would show that had resolved. And so the doc that I work most closely with, his family is here. And towards the end of my pregnancy, he's a strong Christian man. And towards the end of my pregnancy, I come in and I'm telling him about another ultrasound. And he goes, Becca, is it just in my head or is it actually reality that every week you come in and you say, here's what the ultrasound showed last time. Here's the specific thing we prayed for. That resolved. Now we're praying for X. And you come in the next week and you say the exact same thing. And I said, no, that is actually the reality of what my pregnancy was. And so when I tell you that this little guy, I legitimately see miracles in this little dude that I get to come home to every day who's got the quirkiest personality of any kid that I have met, and I just adore him, I literally get to come home to a miracle, and I can tell you in ways that I would have never been able to tell you before that we do serve a God that heals, and we do serve a God of miracles. So my point in all of this very long story here is just pray for healing, and pray for it expectantly, because God can do so much more than we can ask or imagine, and that has to do with our physical health, our mental health, just all of it. Next verse. Next verse up there is from Mark 5. Mark 5 is all about the story in the Bible of where there is a woman who is having bleeding issues, and she's been bleeding, it says, for more than a decade continuously, and she has spent all of her money and all of her resources going to medical provider after medical provider after medical provider saying, help me. And she hears about Jesus and that he is healing people, and she decides that if I get up there and I touch his cloak, I will be healed. And that is exactly what she did. And so she got up there and she touched his cloak. And here's what it says. It says, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed. And actually, Jesus felt power go from him is what the Bible says there. And my point in telling you this is that sometimes we do have to really pursue healing. That's not to say that God isn't in it. It is just that sometimes we really do have to go through all of the effort and see all of the providers and get to the place where we have done everything before we will be healed. And I'm not saying that all of us
will be. But and so to that point, I did also reference, my little guy still has a urologist. He's actually had three surgeries. And two of those surgery were for things called posterior valves, which are highly associated with urinary obstruction. And actually, he of all of the pediatric urologists in Minnesota, at a very least, none of them have heard of a kid that has both posterior and anterior urethral valves, which my little guy did. And both of those are associated with kidney failure at a rate of about 30 to 50% individually. And so when I tell you that his kidneys are perfect and continue to be perfect, like, I cannot express to you how significant of a miracle that is in and of itself. But he does still see urology. He has still had three surgeries. I just had him rushed to the clinic yesterday because I was concerned he could have a UTI because he threw up. Because, you know, these are things that I do still have to think about, and we are still pursuing healing, but that does not discount the miracle that I see in who he is and the things that I have seen God do. My last thing here for you on this screen, the last verse here, 2 Corinthians 12, is where Paul talks about the thorn in his side. And we don't know, and Paul is the author of 2 Corinthians, and just an incredible apostle of God. And we don't know what Paul's thorn in his side was. It doesn't ever tell us in the Bible what that is. But a thorn in your side is, of course, not an ideal thing. And so we know that it was something that he did not want, and was not good. And so it says that Paul prayed three times, asking God to take whatever this was away from him. And this is God's response to him. He says, "But he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weakness so that the power of Christ may rest on me. For when I am weak, then I am strong.' And I will say time and time again in my own life, where I think that I have something that is coming into my life that feels awful and makes me feel weak, I can look back and say, 'God, this is where I learned the most. I did not feel good when I found out that my little guy was, you know, looking like he could die. On this side of it, I am here to tell you, I would not give that back for the world. I know my God and my Jesus in a way that I would have never known otherwise. And I can tell you all about the healing that I have seen in a way that I would have never talked about it authentically previously." So I will also say to that note, especially in regards to anxiety, there is no better thing to call us to be people of prayer than a worried mind. A worried mind is something that God can use. I think that it's like, I think people joke about it and say in a cliche way that our biggest strength is our biggest weakness. But let me tell you, it can also be the opposite, that our biggest weakness is also our biggest strength. And so if you are somebody that naturally has an anxious mind, using that to say, I'm going to use that anxiety and I'm going to say, okay, I'm having a worried thought, I'm going to pray for X, Y, or Z, that is a powerful thing. That's something God can use, and that's something that where I am weak, I can be strong. So, yeah. The next portion of what we are going to go into is all about different things that we can do for anxiety. Hang on 2 seconds. My nose is all kinds of drippy. I'm good. I just have to... Thank you. Okay. We're good. So the next portion that I'm going to go into is all of the different things that we can do for anxiety. And this portion is going to have a lot of different things that you can do for anxiety. Having said that, it is a lot of them. Just because they are listed here does not mean that I want all of you to say, I need to do all of these things. This is not a to-do list for those of you that are very type A. This is a list of all of the things that might be able to be helpful. And I know that in my experience in working in the clinic, that a lot of people that have more of those anxious tendencies also have more perfectionistic tendencies. And so I really can't stress this enough. This is not a to-do list. This is that you all are here with me for an hour, and I don't have 20-minute appointments over the next year to discuss all of these things with you in a maybe this week we should talk about and focus on sort of a manner. So this is me spitballing a lot of different things. So the first slide is up there. So medications I work in a traditional clinic. I do traditional things. Medications can save people's lives. I have seen medications save people's lives. I've also seen medications do not good things to some people. And I know that all of these things are reality. And I think that sometimes if you go to see a medical provider and all they have to offer you is medications and they aren't helping, that can feel like a very defeated place. But so according to the journal, the Diagnosis of Clinical Neuroscience, they did a psychopharmacology review in regards to anxiety medications. We know that anxiety medications as a whole can help about 40 to 80% of people, depending on which medication you're looking at. And I would say that's about what I see in the clinic. There are certainly people that are much more sensitive to medications than other people. And there are certainly people that are that have a lot more side effects than other people. And we can't necessarily predict those things. So medications are certainly trial and error, but I will tell you a lot of these things are. And that doesn't mean that it's not worth pursuing. It just means that sometimes we have to get more creative than we would have otherwise. If we could go to the next slide. The next slide is another one that, yes, you've all probably heard of. And so therapy, of course, another pretty obvious one. In regards to therapy, we know that about 75% of people, according to the American Psychiatric Society, will see some improvement with therapy. Therapy certainly can help and can help people's life. The most common form of therapy is cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and a lot of times that is in those moments saying, how do I ground myself and what do I do in this moment? Back to Max Lucado and Philippians 4:4-8, rejoicing in the Lord, that is a way of grounding ourselves, guys. That is one of the ways that the Bible is saying, in this moment when the world feels like it's out of control, reflect on the goodness of God. Recount his attributes. That is a way that we can ground ourselves. That's not something that a lot of therapists are probably going to tell you guys, but that is a way that we can ground ourselves. Like, these are things that we can see that happen in reality. But having said all of that, while 75% of people do see benefit with therapy, find a therapist you like, because we also know that if you don't like your therapist, therapy will not be effective. My middle brother went through a divorce a couple of years ago, and it was not pretty. We'll just go with that. And so he was in a really dark place mentally, lots of depression, lots of anxiety. He ended up seeing 5 different therapists throughout that time. And he said to me, he goes, Becca, I walked out of that fifth therapist, and I go, huh, that's what therapy's supposed to feel like. But it did take him 5 therapists to get to that point. And so it is worth trying. I have a patient who has seen 22 therapists in their life. They have only ever liked 2 of them. Their primary issue is they don't like that if a therapist says we, because it's not our issues, it's his issues, so he doesn't really want you to take them on. But having said all of that, he would say that the 2 therapists that he has liked have absolutely changed his life and changed his brain. Next slide, if we could. Supplements. And supplements are something that I know you won't have a lot of providers that necessarily talk about. You'll see I have 2 buckets up there. This would kind of be how I think about things in life. And so I would say, in medicine, is that I think we've got 2 good buckets. I think that if we're only picking from 1 bucket, we're leaving a whole nother legitimate bucket behind. And I am just not all about that. And so I'm not going to tell you that I know everything. And by 2 buckets, I mean like a traditional medicine bucket and more of a like less traditional, functional, Eastern, however you want to call that bucket. And so that's how I look at it. The list of supplements that I have up here are supplements that I have used for lots of patients for different things. And I can't tell you what one would be good for you necessarily, because all of this is so individualized. I also have some extra training in something called the Walsh Protocol, where we kind of optimize how your body makes your neurotransmitters. But supplements are certainly something that can be helpful. Next slide, if we could. Sleep. And I think this one maybe seems a little bit obvious, but I think that it may be how it affects our anxious mind is maybe something that we don't look at enough. And so we know that if you have insomnia, you are 17 times more likely to have anxiety. And so sleep really, truly is really important. I will also say a lot of my patients with insomnia can't sleep because they're anxious and they can't get their minds to shut off. We also know that sleep alters 117 different genes, and a lot of those are linked to immunity. So our physical health starts to go down when we're not sleeping, and if our physical health starts to go down, then we're going to start to worry about that, and then we're not going to sleep because we're worrying about that, and I mean, it just goes in a big old circle. But So things that can be helpful. Some of the things that I will say are probably things that you've heard before, but things like going to bed and waking up at a consistent time, even on the weekends. And I will tell you, I am very bad at this. Things like getting enough sleep. The average man needs about 6 to 8 hours of sleep. The average woman needs about 7 to 9 hours of sleep. So you can all go home and tell your hubbies that you need more sleep than he does. Don't go to bed unless you're sleepy. Make sure you kind of have a good bedtime routine. And so for a lot of people, you know, if you just try to go from doing your life to going to bed, that doesn't work great. Blue light is a very real thing. Blue light is the light that is emitted by a lot of our electronics and can make a big difference there. And so you'll see things that recommend anywhere from a half hour to 2 hours before we go to bed, not looking at that blue light. And the reason for that is actually how it affects our body's release of melatonin. So melatonin is a substance that's made in our body, and our body actually starts to make melatonin first thing in the morning, and then it is released at night. And so our melatonin is started production with the onset of light. And there's actually research that shows that the sun, the actual frequency of the frequency is the wrong term, I think, but the tone of light that is associated with the sunrise actually increases our melatonin production much more, which I just think is so cool because, of course, God does that. But so for people that have a lot of insomnia issues, if you go for a walk outside as the sun is rising, that is something that can dramatically increase our melatonin production. And then lights going off at night is what allows that melatonin to be released for us to be asleep. The last thing that I will say about sleep is, and this would be my very non-traditional sleep advice that comes from my mama, truly. My mom has told me since I was a little girl, and this is the thing that I think is probably the most beneficial for me for sleep, is that if I'm not sleeping, it's one of two things. The first thing is God woke me up for a reason, and I need to figure out why. And so just taking that moment to say, God, is there somebody that I'm supposed to pray for? God, is there somebody that I'm supposed to send a note to? Is this the only time of the day that you could get my attention? And so now I'm your captive audience. And I will say that God has used that many times in my life and in other people's life where God has woken me up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I have felt like God has said, you need to call so-and-so. And I'm like, God, it's 2 a.m. No one wants to talk to me. And I have sent them a text, and sure enough, they are awake, and they have said, Becca, I was just about to make the worst decision of my life. That has happened to me on more than one occasion. I'm supposed to write somebody a note. I actually have a patient, it's a note writing. I have a patient who God woke me up at about 2 o'clock in the morning one time and said, Becca, you need to send him a my chart message. He's in a bad place. You need to tell him that there's hope. And I sent this man a message only for him to show up at my clinic about a week later. And he said, Becca, I opened up my email this morning, and I opened up my email this morning with the intention of cleaning out my email so that my family had nothing else that they could find or had to take care of so that I could kill myself. He came in and saw me in the clinic, and he ended up getting a lot more treatment, and we got him admitted to an inpatient unit and all sorts of things. And he came back and he has said, Becca, you are the only reason that I'm alive. And this man, ironically enough, does not believe in God and had never had anybody pray with him or anything before that. But I mean, you can't tell him I woke up and sent you an email at 3 a.m. for no reason. Just really obvious, God wanted him here, and God asked me to be obedient in that moment. So that would be the first thing that my mom has always taught me to do. The second thing that my mom has always taught me to do is that if that doesn't work, and I don't mean this in a creepy way or in a weird way, but if we aren't tuned in with God and the devil wants to distract us, there's no better way to distract us than to make us so fatigued that we can't think straight. You know, that's one of the tools that he would certainly have. And so my mom has said, rebuke Satan. And I can also not tell you how many times I have, and by that I mean, for those of you that are not familiar with that, just saying that Satan could be trying to steal your sleep. And it says that Satan and his demons, his minions, as they would prefer to call them, can't be in the presence of the name of Jesus. And just saying, in the name of Jesus, I demand that you leave, and I'm going to get some sleep. Quit stealing my sleep. I can't even tell you how many times, and you have to say it out loud, because of course, devil can't read your thoughts, but I can't even tell you how many times I have said that out loud, just in a quiet whisper under my voice, and I am asleep before I have finished saying it. The name of Jesus is that powerful, guys. And so that would be my very non-traditional sleep advice for all of you that you won't find in any of the books on good sleep cycles, but is something that I think is just really powerful. Next slide, if we could, physical activity. And I will warn all of you, remember how I said pick some of these and don't use it as a to-do list. This is the area that I struggle the most with all of these things that I am talking about. I have 4 little kids, the oldest of which is 9. And I work a job that is not a not busy job. Finding a time to work out is really, really difficult for me. But physical activity can make a huge, huge difference on the anxious mind. They've done studies where they've compared medications and exercise, and we know that if a medication is, comparing it to like optimal medication use, exercising 45 minutes 6 days a week is equivalent to taking a medication. I realize that's a crazy huge number. They've done studies where they've looked at things as little as about 15 minutes 3 days a week, and you will still see significant improvement in the brain. And the reason for that is that when we exercise, it releases some endorphins, and endorphins actually have a cannabis-like effect on the brain that helps to calm the anxious mind. There isn't the high effect, but so it helps to reduce depression and anxiety. It helps to reverse brain aging, improve memory, improve attention, elevate mood, increase stress resiliency, and improve academic achievement in children. And so physical activity does make a huge, huge difference. Like I said, this is the area that is on my goal list to figure out. But it has been for quite some time, and I will make strides, and then it just doesn't stick. But so... Anyway, physical activity, huge. Next slide, if we could. Food. If there are questions that will derail me in the clinic, it is about food because I just geek out, guys. This is like my brain just kind of buzzes from thing to thing about kind of nutrition science. I get so, so very dorky about these things. But the book that I have listed up there is, that's a book. It's called This Is Your Brain on Food. It's written by Dr. Uma Nayadu. She is a Harvard-trained MD who teaches at Harvard. She runs the only inpatient nutritional psychiatry program in the country out of Massachusetts General. So inpatient nutritional psychiatry, what that means is that she's treating people whose mental health is bad enough that they have to be in the hospital. And she is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist, so she knows every psychiatric medication that there is, but the nutritional piece would mean she has opted to treat them essentially with food. And what we are finding is that 30 of our neurotransmitters are made in our gut. And our neurotransmitters are those chemicals that actually help to regulate our mood. And so if our gut is not healthy, our brain will not be healthy. Dr. Nayadu talks about the vagus nerve is a nerve that connects directly to our brain, but also connects to our stomach. And she calls it the super highway between the two of them. And so really, if one doesn't work, the other won't work. I can't remember where this one's coming from, but I can't remember where it is. What my reference is on this one. It is from her book, if you have an anxiety diagnosis, you are about 30 to 50 times, I think it was, more likely to have an IBS diagnosis. Just that connection between the gut and the brain is that significant. The reason that I talk, and there are lots of other books in this field as well. This field is booming. Australia just recently changed its guidelines on how it treats depression and anxiety because of the work of a Dr. Felicia Jacka out of their Food Mood Center. She would be one of the counterparts right there. There's a Dr. Drew Ramsey out of Columbia. All of this is really, really new research. Like I said, I really geek out about. But the reason I reference her book all the time is because it's just so user-friendly. So if you wanted to read the 25 pages in the chapter on anxiety, you could read the 25 pages on the chapter in anxiety, and it lists out the foods not to eat and the foods to eat. And so in her chapter on anxiety specifically, she talks about how the Western diet with processed foods, and by processed foods, I basically mean if it came in a package, it would fit that processed food category. And so flours that are real milled down, like anything that basically you don't have to digest as much because it's already been digested for you in the processing a little bit. That would kind of fit some of the foods that we're talking about there. Lots of sugar, those sorts of things. Caffeine could make, processed foods can make anxiety worse. Caffeine, alcohol, gluten, artificial sweeteners. Those would be some of the things that she talks about as foods that can make things worse. for things that can make anxiety better. She talks a lot about dietary fiber, omega-3s, fermented foods, things like yogurt, kefir, those kinds of things. And then she does also reference some supplements in there that could be helpful as well. We know that in terms of how healthy our gut is, that if the bacteria in our gut is more diverse, that then increases our health. And so diversity of gut bacteria improves health. And so how do we diversify our gut bacteria? The research on that says that the diversity of produce in our diet largely dictates that. And so 5 different types of produce being fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, whole grains, 5 different types throughout the course of a day, and 30 different types throughout the course of a week, which anytime I say that, people think that sounds overwhelming. But if it's something that you start to focus on, it becomes much, much easier. And things like a smoothie with seeds sprinkled on top, you can easily get 15 things in there. You know. So anyway, that would be my little blurb on food. I could talk about it all day. I will move on. Next slide, if we could. Gratitude. I read Max Lucado's book that I referenced earlier, Anxious for Nothing, several years ago, and I actually flipped it open because this quote is what has probably stuck in my head the most from that book, and I couldn't remember it word for word. But what he says is that if it came in pill form, gratitude would be deemed a miracle cure. And I just think that is so very true. Gratitude increases the activity in the hypothalamus, which helps us to control our eating, our drinking, our sleeping. And so if we are more grateful, more likely that we're going to have a healthy relationship with all of those things. There's another book that is Get Out of Your Head by Jenny Allen. And in that book, she also talks significant, and that book's also about anxiety. And in that book, she also talks a lot about gratitude. And she says that it increases our physical health, increases our relational quality, enhances empathy, reduces aggression, improves self-esteem, and increases resiliency. And resiliency is that idea that I went through something hard and I can get through it and do the next thing, and that I can still have a good life despite how horrible this thing was. Which of course made me think of Brené Brown, who's the other person that I have a quote up there from. And Brené Brown is a social worker, for those of you that are not familiar with her, who has spent her whole career looking at the idea of resiliency. And just looking at those people that she calls the fully living, who are the people that that love well and live well. And so she says that the secret to all of that is gratitude. And so she says, a good life happens when you stop and are grateful for the ordinary moments that so many of us steamroll over and try to find those extraordinary moments. And so just the idea of just being so thankful in the moment is just a very, very powerful thing. There are lots of ways that you can practice gratitude. These can be things like a gratitude journal and writing down a couple of things in the morning and the evening that you are grateful for. In Brené Brown's house, she says that they practice gratitude by going around every dinner and just saying what everybody is thankful for that day. I didn't know this research, but back in high school, I knew that my brain wasn't doing some things that I wanted it to do, so I decided that as I walked, I was going to just look for things that I could like. I didn't know I was practicing gratitude at the time, and just trying to make those the well-trudged paths in my brain, that neuroplasticity would be looking for the good things instead of looking for the bad things. So gratitude is powerful. Next slide, if we could. Having said that gratitude is powerful, I think that what we take in from a social media perspective really, really matters. Another book would be Kimberly Wilson's How to Build a Healthy Brain. And in that book, she references a couple of studies on social media and the media. And if we all haven't realized that the media affects our brains yet, I don't think we have watched the news in the past 2 years. In there, she references a couple of things. So the first one is what I have essentially listed up here. She said a study that she referenced, and both of these studies were done on teenage girls. But having said that, if somebody is just going through passive Facebook use, that it is more, and by that I mean just kind of flipping through, looking at everybody's life and their pictures and their quotes and all of that, that it is more likely that they are going to have greater social comparison with kind of like ability and what is going on with who they are. They're going to have lower self-esteem and then greater levels of depression. So if it's just passive and we're just taking in whatever comes to us, that can cause problems essentially. On the flip side, she says that if we are they took this, another group of teenage girls, and they changed what they were looking at. And so they chose who these girls were following and made them positive influences that were essentially contributing to some of their goals for later in life. And they found that when they did that, it actually improved their ability to achieve those goals and improved their self-esteem. And so what you take in matters, which whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is noble, whatever is excellent, whatever is praiseworthy, think about these things. I just think that this is just reiterating what God has told us since the beginning. But that would be my little blurb on social media. Next slide, if we could. Friends. Get some friends. And I realize that sounds like such an easy state. Like when you say it, it sounds so easy. And I know that it is not easy. My hubby and I have an amazing group of friends right now. And we prayed for a small group in our church that we could be a part of that would be a couple small group where we could just find our tribe for well over a decade. When I tell you that I have had crash and burn small groups, I literally mean one of my small groups was two other couples, and within the first 4 months of us meeting as a small group, both of those couples said that they were getting a divorce, and two of them started having an affair and are now married, and they were pastors. When I tell you I have never experienced, like I have experienced crash and burn in this area, I mean it hardcore, guys. All of that being the case, when I tell you this is something that I prayed for, and I've seen God answer this prayer, and this isn't something that I have come by easily, know that I mean that really, 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 really. But this group of friends that I have now is just an incredible group of friends, and I am so, so very thankful for them. The number one indicator of resiliency is the support of friends and just having those people who come alongside of us. And when I thought of this, I couldn't help but think of the areas in the world where we see people live the longest, healthiest lives are called blue zones. And there is a researcher, Dan Buettner, who's out of the National Geographic, who has studied these areas. And in all of those areas that he has found these people that live these long, healthy lives, he has found a really deep relational connection, particularly in this area in Japan where people live the longest, healthiest lives, which is Okinawa, Japan. There is something called a Maui. And these are groups that are actually started when they're actually typically kids, and they grow up with these people, and these groups were started so that they could help support each other personally, financially, physically, mentally, just that when life gets hard, these are the people that you turn to. And this is one of the things that is found to be a commonality among these people who live long, healthy lives. I just think that's just such a wonderful thing for all of us. There's research to show that volunteering does some of this for us, and that if you are in a state where you are volunteering, that it actually increases happiness and longevity. And additionally, that's also a place where a lot of times people will find really fabulous friends. And so if this is an area that you are struggling in, one, pray about it. Two, go volunteer somewhere. I bet you'll find people that have a like-mindedness and that are people that you could really connect with. I'm almost done, guys. Next slide, if we could. Meditation and prayer. I said I was going to come back to this. So I was already telling you kind of about those big healing prayers. But prayer in general, and this is out of Jenny Allen's Get Out of Your Head that I had referenced a little bit ago. We know that people who pray scientifically show brain differences. So if you do like MRIs of their brain, their actual brain looks different. They have younger brains. So as we age, if we are people that pray, our brain is actually younger. It increases the alpha waves in our brain, and that decreases depression and anxiety. And we have less default mode thinking, that thinking that I was talking about where we just go back to whatever that path is. Because if our default mode is prayer, how awesome is that? And so when you think about things in the Bible, like in Thessalonians, it says pray continuously. You can make it so that your default mode is prayer. And when I think of prayer, I cannot help but think of a lady in my church. Her name is Wanda. And Wanda happens to be one of my favorite people in the whole wide world. Wanda is 88. And my husband recently spoke at it's a group at our church called Encompass. And Encompass is like old person youth group. There are like 50 to 80, 70 to 80 year olds that all get together, and they all talk over each other just like kids in youth ministry do. It's actually hilarious to me. But my husband recently spoke there, and she sent him a text afterwards, and his, I can't even remember what verses he was out of, but it was about kind of being willing to change the world. And she texted him and she goes, I am an 88-year-old woman who wants to be a countercultural Jesus lover. And I was like, you go, Wanda. So I just adore Wanda. But having said all of that, Wanda is a woman that prays. Wanda probably sends us a note in the mail probably about once a month or so, telling us how thankful she is that she gets to pray for my family. And Wanda is one of those people that when we found out that my little guy was not doing well while he was in utero, all of that, is one of those people that we turned to and asked her to pray for our little guy. And so she and this group of ladies from this old person youth group all started to pray for our kids. And the first time that we brought Titus, my little Sky, to church, they all got together and they all asked to hold him. And of course, we're happy to let them hold him. And they all kind of started to get a little bit emotional about it. And I'm going to get emotional about it now again, too. And what they said is, and they had never told me this before that time, they said, Becca, about a decade ago, we all started praying together that we'd get to hold a miracle. And so come to find out, all of those prayers that we had prayed that we now see answered in our little guy actually started 10 years ago, before he was even a twinkle in our eyes, even a thought that we had had, because God answers prayers and does things in that way that is just so very powerful that we can't even think about the fact that God sees this whole parade and we're only seeing this tiny little snapshot. And so I'm just so, so very thankful for them. But I will say, back to all of this, prayer has changed their brains. They all interact in a way that I can tell you, I see 88-year-olds in the clinic. Wanda's the only one that has ever told me she wants to actually keep doing things. And she actually recently sent us a note that said, she said, Becca, I'm just, in the letter that she sent us, beautiful penmanship, just everything that you would think goes with somebody named Wanda. In that note, she said, Becca, I'm just so thankful that even though I'm getting older and I'm 88, that I serve a God that even if my body has completely failed me, I can still pray and God can still use that. And so I can just tell you, I've prayed for a long time. God, I want to know what I want to look like when I'm 88. I want to look like Wanda. And so I want you all to look like Wanda as well. And I think that that is one of those things that if we have an idea of what we want to be and what it looks like to live faithfully for a lifetime, that is something that calms our anxious mind. So I realize that not all of these things are a linear path to not being anxious, but they help. Last slide, we're at the end. This is the last place that I wanted to stop. And so I've talked a couple of times here about neuroplasticity and just that the things that we think about are the things that we think about. Having said that, this is one of those verses that I come to again and again when I look at my Bible. And so let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O God, my rock and my redeemer. The reason I keep coming back to this all the time is, one, that whole, like, where does our brain go when we're not thinking about what we're thinking about? But this words meditations here is actually a musical term, is what I found out. And it basically means, what is the constant humming? So what is the constant humming of my heart? Is the constant humming of my heart anxious thoughts? Is the constant humming of my heart acceptable to God? And if the constant humming of my heart is that God is my rock and my redeemer, the things that come and hit me aren't going to hit me the same way. One of the things that I hadn't mentioned previously is my daughter's name is Hope. My daughter's name is Hope, actually, because we went through infertility treatments trying to get pregnant with her, and we weren't sure we were going to be able to have kids. And the lesson that God taught me during that time period was that if I never have kids, or if I do have kids and all of a sudden they die suddenly and now I no longer have kids again, that my hope is secure. My hope is always in heaven and is only in heaven. And so if that is the place that we are founded, is that is our rock, we are unshakable, because the constant meditations of our heart, the humming that is constantly inside of us, is saying, God, I trust you. God, I know you've got this. I know I don't know the next thing that's coming, but you do. And I will just be faithful, because that is my job in this moment. And if that's where we come from, we don't need to be anxious. And we don't need to worry about, am I going to get COVID? Am I going to die of COVID? Is so-and-so going to die of COVID? What about job? What about this and what about that? I'm not saying that those things don't matter, but I just wanted to encourage all of you that just if we can think about the constant meditations of our heart, that was the thought that I wanted to leave you with, that that will change who we are. So that's what I've got. Questions on anxiety? Any thoughts? To Wanda, I agree. Yes, I sent her a letter that told her a lot of all of that, and she apparently told me that she keeps a box under her bed of all of her special things in life, that the letter that I sent her saying, you gave me an idea of what I want to look like when I'm 88 is one of those things that went in her box. So, oh, yes, absolutely, yes. Yes, my mother-in-law died of colon cancer that was caught on a 50-year-old colonoscopy, and she did pray miracle, big miracle prayers that that she would be cured of that. But she said, Becca, the reality is that if I am cured of this cancer, I win. I get to see my grandbabies. I get to keep living life. I get to keep being used by God. And that if I die, I get to go to heaven and see my Savior face to face, and I win. Yeah. Yep. Any other thoughts or questions? If not, you're all welcome to find me later. Okay. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, you all have a great day. Thanks.